You're listening to El Clásico, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España from Barcelona to Madrid. Today we are at Xorret de Catí.
You are indeed listening to El Clásico. My name is Daniel Freiber and I'm the host of this episode. And I am on Xorret de Catí, a place whose name means trickle in the local dialect, but where the drama flowed in rivers this afternoon. On such a day, it seemed only correct to call upon a writer and commentator noted for effusive and romantic prose and soliloquies. And hence, please join me in welcoming the mustachioed, wistful gazer himself from a couple of hundred kilometers south of here in Almería. It's Fran Reyes. Fran, how are we doing?
Hello, Daniel. How much I have enjoyed this introduction. I might use it for my Tinder biography.
Oh, too much information already. Fran, the pronunciation of X's in the local dialect, Xorret?
Xorret.
Xorret. Yes. Fran, tell the listeners where we are, because we're somewhere very special. Not just Xorret de Catí, but somewhere more specific than that. Where exactly are we? What are we perched on?
We are in the base of a monument to cycling that was installed here. But problem is that the statue that crowned this monument is no longer here. Which probably makes us pieces of art, by the way, I think of it. But yeah, it was a bronze statue, 2 meters tall, 2 meters wide.
300 kilograms, apparently, it weighed.
Yeah, exactly, 300 kilograms. And it was stolen overnight, 3 months and a half ago, just in the wake of the Spanish election.
Yeah, this was a statue that was... When was it installed, Fran? It was installed after a few editions of the Vuelta had come to this finish. We're just outside the hotel, the eponymous hotel, the Hotel Xorret de Catí. And, well, in a very short time, this climb, after it was premiered in the Vuelta a España, we talked about that a few days ago, it built quite a reputation, didn't it? It was referred to as the Mortirolo of Alicante by some.
And
That's a big compliment to pay a climb. But it became so sort of infamous that, as you say, they wanted to, well, make it a real monument, not just a sort of metaphorical monument, but a monument of cycling in these parts. And, well, the statue was built here. The names of everyone who has won here adorn the side of this monument, including, incidentally, it's not just men's cycling, Clara Koppenberg, who won here in 2019. Hopefully, well, we think Primoz Roglic's name will soon adorn the side. That's not too much of a spoiler, I hope. And Fran, there's still no one, it seems, is any the wiser as to what happened to this, well, the 300 kilo bronze cyclist. 300 kilo, it wasn't Jan Ulrich. but the very heavy cyclist that was stolen. Who knows where it is? Have you got any leads, Fran?
No,
can you help the investigation? Who would do such a thing?
You know what usually happens here when someone steals bronze or copper is that they melt it and send it in the black market. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was the case with this statue. It would be such a shame because after all it had a value as art, but it happens all the time in Spain, really. I mean, if there are construction works and there is no one to watch for the materials, someone comes and steal them, you know, particularly, as I said, the copper and metallic materials.
Fran, we're very familiar with statues to cyclists, and one cyclist in particular. There are, I don't know, maybe a dozen Marco Pantani statues dotted around Italy usually on various climbs, but there are a couple in places where he owned property or spent short amounts of time. Have you got a favourite one in Spain, or are there any favourite ones in Spain? You're laughing, you're giggling, why?
Well, because my favourite one in Spain is Samuel Sanchez statue,
yes,
in Oviedo.
Bottom of the Naranjo in Oviedo.
Yeah, exactly.
On the roundabout, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. I like it for several reasons. One was that a former teammate of his told me that one day, after one Vuelta a Asturias stage, they were going back to the hotel, and he told him, hey, wait a second, instead of going straight to the hotel by bike, we're going to take a small tour. And they made a 5-10 kilometer tour just for him to show his teammate the status of him. For a while,
I would do the same. I would do the same.
Yeah, of course. Feel honored. For a while, it was his WhatsApp profile picture. I can tell you also that his Telegram profile picture is the sign of Calle Samuel Sánchez, Samuel Sánchez Street. I don't know where it is, but that's his Telegram profile picture. And on its day, I went to this statue. The statue portrays him biting his gold medal, the one that he won in Beijing in 2008. And I took a pretty cringe selfie on which I beat the medal along with him. You know, I can send it to you. We can't post it. We can't post it for some reason.
You're all right, Fran. You're right. We'll just imagine that. And Fran, we mentioned this the other day, Samuel Sánchez's statue in Oviedo, because there are lots of interesting statues in Oviedo, including one to Charlie Chaplin. No, not Charlie Chaplin. What am I talking about? Woody Allen, Tino Casal as well, has a statue in downtown Oviedo. And Fran, we'd better talk about today's race. And it was a thrilling one. I was going to ask you one other question before we do. Can't remember what it was. Maybe some. Oh, Samuel Sánchez. Was there not some controversy about the statue when he tested positive, when he had his doping case? I have a vague memory of there being calls for it to be taken down.
I don't have.
Maybe it. Not. Maybe not. Fran, can we have the tale of the etapa, please?
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
Of course, Daniel. Your wishes are a pleasure for me to obey. Stage 8 of this 2023 Vuelta a España, ridden over 165 kilometers between Denia and Choret de Catí. It was a bit of a hectic start, really, for a bunch that was as frightened about the four categorized climbs spread over the course as it was about the final wall-like climb to Choret de Catí. They were also frightened about Jumbo Visma, because after what they did the other day in Jabalambre, they could foresee that they were going to set a strong pace.
And about the weather.
And also about the weather, because that was a factor of uncertainty. There was awful weather announced. So far, it hasn't rained, but it might be time for raining as we record the podcast. You know, we are recording outside.
My paraguas, my umbrella.
I do have one too. we are well prepared. Anyway, there was this early 14-rider break at the beginning, but it was shut down after 30 kilometers. Afterwards, 30-strong group went clear, with Arkea Samsic's Christian Rodriguez as the best place rider in GC, yet he was 4 minutes in arrears of red jersey wearer Lenin Martinez. Back in the bunch, Groupama, FDJ and Jumbo Visma kept things together, and in the Puerto La Carrasqueta, Dutch Gregario Robert Gesing took the reins. On its summit, 55 kilometers from the finish, the gap between the break and the bunch that was reduced already to 40 cyclists was clocked at 3 minutes 30. With 40k to go, Movistar teams Javier Lazcano, Lotto Destinies Andreas Kron, Intermarché's Rui Costa and Bahrain Victorious Damiano Caruso established a four-man group at the front. Yet their attempt was hopeless, as Jumbo-Visma pulled strongly and reeled them in at the foot of the final climb, indeed, with 6 kilometers left to race. Once in the steep slopes of Choret del Catí, Sop Kuss was the first to attack, with Remco Evenepoel setting a fierce pace in a favorite group on which there were only 6 other riders. Primoz Roglic, Jonas Vingegaard. Can we say Roligard from now on? Since they are riding together.
I like
Roligard.
It. Roligard, okay. Yeah, I like
so,
it.
So it was Roligard, Enric Mas, and a UAE Team Emirates trio with Juan Ayuso, Max Soler and Joao Almeida. Kuss was eventually brought back and the 8 men sprinted for the win on the fast downhill to the finish line, with Roglic taking the best of Evenepoel and Ayuso, while his teammate Sepp Kuss took the red jersey from Lenny Martinez, who was dropped early in the climb and crossed the finish line 1 minute 10 seconds later than the stage winner.
Fran, a lot of changes on general classification before we get to them. Kuss-Ligard, can we get away with that?
Kuss-Ligard?
Kuss-Ligard.
Yeah, it goes far, but it's good.
But Roglic has I fear that Roglic's role in that, Roglic has too small a part of that appellation, which may not reflect actual events. Fran, So let's look at, well, some of the winners and losers briefly. Let's look at general classification first of all. Sepkus, as you said, is now in the red jersey. Second, Marc Soler, which I wouldn't have foreseen this morning. He's moved up one place. He's 43 seconds down on Sepkus. Third place, Lenny Martinez. A very valiant defence of his red jersey today. Wout Poels, who not a lot of people have spoken about yet in this welter, 2 minutes, 5 seconds down. He's in fifth. Then Mikel Landa. There are some wags I noticed on Spanish social media suggesting that he leads the real Vuelta a España. But Landa has found himself in a very good position.
Yeah. Especially given that he has been very sick this first week.
He's one of those who have been sick, is he?
Not in his stomach, but he got he was under the weather. He had a strong cold ahead of the race. It got worse in Barcelona with the rain and the awful weather that we had. And the other day in Javalambre, when I spoke to him, he was constantly gasping for breath and spitting out. He was still undergoing that, but he told me that he was feeling much better after a few awful days.
And Fran, probably the worst week of the welter in terms of the course for him is out of the way, so he could not have dreamed of being in a better position. And then, to some minds, the real general classification starts with Remco Evenepoel in sixth. Primoz Roglic just 7 seconds behind him. Jonas Vingegaard just 4 seconds behind Roglic. And then Enric Mas on the same time. And Juan Ayuso, 2 minutes and 52 down. So he is just over 20 seconds, 21 seconds behind Remco Evenepoel. There were other sort of significant movers today. Losers, I suppose you would say. Geraint Thomas had another tough day. I spoke to him this morning. He had both knees bandaged up at the start this morning. And he said that, well, both knees were hurting. At this point, I think his left knee was slightly worse than his right. But he didn't have particularly high expectations for today. And he's now in 23rd place on general classification. 8 minutes and 43 seconds down. Fran, there were other notable performances which we'll discuss in due course, but you were at the finish line, as I was, and our attention, I think I speak for everyone, was drawn immediately to Remco Evenepoel's reaction when he came over the line. And those of us who sort of chased him to where his soigneurs were waiting saw a very angry Remco Evenepoel. So angry, in fact, that he didn't want to speak to the press initially. And we didn't know what it was about. We then found out that he was frustrated at not having known or not having been told that he was sprinting against Primoz Roglic for the stage win. But I've watched the replays and I'm not sure it really would have changed anything. I mean, it looked like a pretty full-blooded sprint from Remco.
Exactly. To be honest, I saw two riders that were pretty upset at the finish. One was Remco, and hearing the reasons, I don't think that he could have done anything better. I mean, he did a super climb. He was there setting a pace that no one could overtake, because it didn't look as it though. I mean, the Marc Soler had the theory that actually both Primoz and Jonas, no, Rogligar on itself, they both have the legs as to pass Remco anytime they want it, but they just kept things together.
Marc Soler said that.
Yes, they kept things together because they wanted Sepkus to take the red jersey, which would indeed make a lot of sense, because you still have the red jersey, but your leaders don't have to go through the hassle of the podium duties and this kind of stuff.
And the moment when Kus came back, having made his attack on the Jerez de Cati climb, the moment when in theory it would have been the time to counter, that is where the climb flattens out a few hundred meters before the summit, and it was probably no longer an ideal move at that point. But yeah, I was slightly flummoxed by Remco saying that. He did speak to the media later and did clear up that was exactly why he was so frustrated. But there's always drama with Remco, isn't there? Not in a bad way, but in a sort of exciting way as well. You can never take your eyes off him. And as you said, I thought he sort of policed that group brilliantly on the upper slopes of Jerez de Cati. Very quickly took the decision that the thing to do was to get on the front and to ride a fast tempo to stop the Jumbo Visma hornets, the sort of killer bees, from attacking in sequence one after the other, and it did work really nicely. Fran, without further ado, let's hear from some of the protagonists today. Let's hear from the second half of Roglicard. Was it Roglicard? Let's hear from Jonas Vingegaard. We're going to hear from Robert Hasink, who was really instrumental in an imposing, impressive Jumbo-Visma performance today to bring the break back. And let's hear as well from one of the members of that breakaway who had their hopes dashed. It's our good friend, King Kenny Elizonde of Little Trek.
Yeah, I mean, I'm of course super proud of how we rode. We rode super well today. The guys pulling on the front and the guys on the last climb, so was perfect today.
What was the decision? Was the decision that Primoz would always go for the stage win in a scenario like that?
Yeah, in a scenario like this, yes. But we also talked about that we could go on the last climb. So, but there, Remco was super strong. So, I think for us it was almost more about following than attacking.
Jonas, the other day you seemed to be on a sort of upward trend. You were getting better. Did that continue today? Did you feel even better today?
Not necessarily. Didn't have my best day today, but hopefully I can have that the next 2 weeks.
Well, yeah, it was a bit of hard work to get that group back. It was quite a big group, obviously it's all worth it if it's for these two leaders and we're really happy with obviously with the stage, but maybe even a bit more with Red for Sepp, because it's well deserved.
How much did it cost you guys out there? How much effort did you have to put in it? Because you got the victory and you got the leader's jersey, but you didn't get rid of Remco Evenepoel.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was quite some work, that's for sure. But during the work, I was thinking of day after tomorrow. It's a rest day, so I can recover a bit. Time trial afterwards, also recovery day. So then we'll be all charged again. That would have been even better if that also would have worked, but that's not cycling, it's not PlayStation, right? So you have to put your leaders in the position to do great things, and then obviously it all has to fall in its place, and for now we're doing a good job.
We're all wondering who of the three will win the Vuelta. What is your bet?
I'm at the moment okay with all three, actually, but let's continue racing like this, and let's continue enjoying the teamwork we can do like this, and then we'll see who comes out on top.
Thank you. Robert, just one question. In 2009, it was a very different day for you on this climb. You were fighting with the sort of GC guys at the front. Did you think about that today?
That was funny, actually. I was with two really young guys, and then I Sean Quinn and Poole in the end.
Yep. Cool.
His name is, I think. And I told him, actually, you realize when you're getting really old when you are on a climb, and halfway through you realize, flip, I've been here sometime before. I thought it was 2008, though, so I'm getting that old that I can't even remember the year it was. But back in the day, it was GC times, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I tried everything to be in the break. First, we were a group of 12, I think, on the flat. Then we went again at the top of Val d'Ebo. The group was too big, to be honest, 31. The cooperation was not ideal, and then it went on a strategic path a little bit on the flat, and then I just tried to place Juan P at the bottom of the climb, and at the end of the day I would have need still 3 minutes to after a hard day like this. I would still have need 3 minutes to win with this steep climb. So yeah, I mean, I took pleasure at least, you know. So I prefer to suffer in a breakaway than at the back, because I think on this kind of parkour at the back it must be hard or so. No, was it?
Yeah, very hard.
On the magical.
Yeah.
I think it was also hard at the back. So hard in the front or hard at the back, I prefer to be rather at the front now.
And did you know? Were you pretty sure this morning that Jumbo Visma would work all day, which is what happened?
No, because at first it was planning to be raining, so the road would be slippery. I would think maybe they would play it safe. But yeah, you know, they are this kind of team on this parkour, and they can grind the whole peloton. Yeah? They can destroy everybody, and then Primoz, eh? Why not, eh? Voila.
You know what I mean, huh? Last thing, Kenny. Did you? How do you enjoy the last climb? Enjoy is the wrong word, but you know, when you know that you're not going to win the stage, could you sort of, well, savor the moment a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy because, I had a good day in the front. Then I could still do my job to place Juan Pe in a good position at the bottom. So at the end, I couldn't do more. So at the end, I can just enjoy the people around, you know, try to do some stupid thing with them. And, yeah, one day less.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2023 Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, Fran, the last voice we heard there was King Kenny Elizondo. I had a lovely chat with Kenny this morning. It was shades of Fran Reyes, echoes of Fran Reyes, because he was in wistful mood, Kenny. He was reflecting on a lot of things, reflecting on Lenny Martinez being in the red jersey. We drew this parallel yesterday between Lenny Martinez and King Kenny Elizondo, riders of similar stature. Kenny was surrounded with similar hype when he turned professional, a very promising climber then. But he certainly, Kenny's very impressed with the way Lenny Martinez is riding. But Kenny was also just talking about how brutally difficult this sport has become because of riders like Lenny Martinez and because of that generation, the Kian Utebrookses of this world, the Juan Ayusos, who are so willing to make sacrifices that Kenny's generation didn't necessarily have to make 10 or 12 years ago, when once the season was over, they would take 4 weeks off, 6 weeks off. And he was talking to me this morning about how the pressure has become pretty sort of suffocating to lead the same life that these young guys are leading, and to make an awful lot of sacrifices. And Kenny gave it a good go in the break today, but unfortunately, as I said, his hopes and those of many others were dashed. But Fran,
young riders, they haven't known another sport other than this one, in which you have to weigh what you eat, watch what you do outside of the bike. There was this moment in time 10-15 years ago in which someone will tell me with awe and surprise that whenever a professional rider went to a bar, the first thing he did was finding a stool in order to sit down and not get his legs tired. Still, yesterday I was talking to a master 40 cyclist from Alicante, and he was telling me that he was happy to be there watching the finish line in Oliva, but that he was a bit worried because in 2 days' time she had the Alicante Master 40 Time Trial Championship. So this is the evolution of the sport, even to the most ridiculous extent, on which even recreational riders are worried about getting their legs tired. And even recreational riders are working with nutritionists and working with coaches. So I understand Kenny's frustration, because it is an evolution of the sport that has caught in the middle and has caught the best out of this generation between 90 and 95, which has never been able to express its full potential, I believe.
We'll hear, Fran, later in the episode from another rider of Kenny's generation who will make similar points, make similar sort of observations about the Gen Z contingent of the professional peloton and how difficult it is to keep pace with them. Fran, let's go back in time, shall we, to this morning in Denia. We expected, as I said earlier, a pretty filthy day weather-wise, but we also expected an exciting day, and we thought there might be a bit of a shootout between Jumbo-Visma and Remco Evenepoel. That's what we saw. But, well, let's hear from Primoz Roglic, a characteristically short and mischievous, impish, I would even say, interview. Can you call it that? This is what Primoz Roglic said this morning about what was in store at Jerez de Cati.
El Diario Roglic.
Well, how are you feeling, Primoz? How are the legs? How's the confidence?
We see. On the steep climb, how much?
So that was Roglic. Brief, to the point, as I said, impish as always. Now we're going to hear from Remco Evenepoel on what he was thinking about today's stage. Today's very explosive finish this morning in Denia. Much more elaborate, much more expansive, as Remco tends to be these days in the mixer. And this was Remco this morning in Denia.
El Diario Remco. The Daily Remco.
Not too much. I had to look up on YouTube to see some videos about it, because my teammate Julian won there last time, so it looks like a shorter but a very, very steep one. So yeah, maybe not the hardest climb of the whole Vuelta, but if you have some bad legs, you can lose some brutal time there.
Okay, how much were these explosive climbs, 20%, how much was that a part of your preparation, a big part of your preparation for the Vuelta?
Not a big part, but yeah, I think nobody really focuses on like 10-15 minute climbs. It's more, especially with Tourmalet and all those climbs coming, it's more about the 1 hour climbs. So yeah, it's just something that we have to take. But of course, everything that it was, that is going to be before in the stage, is already going to be pretty brutal. So it's going to be a pretty long and hectic day today.
So Fran, all talk of who this climb was going to suit sort of paled into insignificance, as it often does. What we tend to find in Grand Tours is that there is one rider who's clearly superior to all the others on the climbs, on all of the climbs. And we see evidence of that whenever the road does go uphill. But in this Vuelta a España, it's quite difficult to know. Well, it's certainly quite difficult to know what direction this race is going to take. Also on the basis of what we saw today, isn't it? Because Remco, we feared that he might be ill. We feared that he might be not in as great form, or not in the form that we thought he brought into this race when he got dropped the other day. However, he was back to full Remco today, wasn't he?
Yeah, because what I find in this Vuelta that is very interesting is, of course, as you say, we don't know still who has the upper hand when it comes on face-to-face showdowns in the mountains. Yet the narrative is built, I feel, around Remco Evenepoel. You know, it's what Remco Evenepoel does is what makes the race on one direction or the other. The other day in Javalambre, since he was dropped, then Jumbo Visma pulled the trigger, really, to try and kill him. Today, since he wasn't dropped, he set the pace, and Jumbo Visma waited, indeed, on his wheel once Sepp Kuss was caught, in order to beat him in the finish line. So the narrative spins around him. And that's very interesting and tells a lot about the character of Remco and Poole. You were describing them, Primoz and Remco, and I found it quite spot on. Well, I mean, it is quite funny when we say that something is spot on just because we agree with that, you know? But yeah, I fully agree with your description. And I think that it has an effect on the racing as well. I don't think that Jonas Vingegaard has as much impact on the races as his palmarès says. Really, because
there's a sort of a gravitational force, there's a magnetic force around Remco that kind of sucks the narrative of the race with him. Exactly. If you know, that's not to sound too, I don't know.
Exactly. Even if afterwards,
whimsical.
Sorry.
If that doesn't sound too whimsical.
Yeah. No, but I think it's the case, at least from the spectator's point of view, because later when you speak with the riders, today I was amused. And it was clear that they have had the conversation between them. Three different young riders told me, young Spanish riders, told me how frustrated they were because Jumbo Visma wouldn't even leave the scraps for grabs. Because their style of racing, the way they pace the peloton, makes it impossible for the breakaway to make it to the finish unless something really, really extraordinary happens, as did in this stage of Tour de France. I can't recall which one exactly, in which there was this huge crash as the breakaway was being established and the breaker, we got a very big gap, and thanks to that, made it to the finish. Otherwise, it is nearly impossible. That leads to frustration, but it is a frustration that, sporting-wise, makes no sense. If they are stronger than you, that lack.
Yeah, the other thing with Jumbo-Visma so far in this Vuelta a España, they've had one or two problems. Wilco Kelderman's come down twice, I think, but they haven't had any major issues. They haven't lost any riders, and that's sort of been a bit of a rarity for them. As good as they've been in Grand Tours, you know, they've had Roglic crash out of the Tour de France, so they're at full power. So any tiny scrap of hope there might have been for the breakaway on a day when Jumbo-Visma were interested in going for the stage win, that's completely gone, because they are steamrolling this race, aren't they?
Mm-hmm, exactly. And by the words that Mark Soler was saying, and also by the words that we were referring earlier from Mark Soler, I think they probably have a bit more, some more card on their sleeve. You know, they still have something else to play. The Tourmalet stage again. You know, I said the other day it was a silver bullet. Afterwards, they have another two stages with pretty long climbs, and it's there when they can wear Remco Evenepoel out, which is, I think, the strength or the skill that they can put into play, their superior endurance compared to a younger, less experienced and less Grand Tour proven rider as Remco when compared to Roglic and Vingegaard.
Fran, how much of a distraction is Sepp Kuss, or maybe a decoy for from Jumbo-Visma's point of view, but you could also call him a distraction. I mean, how much does he actually matter in this whole one? Narrative was the word I used a minute ago. You know, him attacking today on Jerez de Cati, obviously, it seemed to sort of coax Remco to the front of the front of proceedings at that point, and he did have to set the pace. But can he almost ignore Sepp Kuss?
Well, he can't. I mean, I think it is an added factor of stress for Remco Evenepoel, especially, you know, if you think that you don't have a Sepp Kuss yet. You know, you don't have... There is this excellent Alberto Contador bit in Eurosport, on which he messes up English very funnily, you know, and he talks about muscles instead of muscles. And one of the things that he says is, it is important to have a Kuss. You know, it is very important to have a Kuss, really. And in this case, Suda Quickstep doesn't have a Kuss yet. They believe that they will have a Kuss with Mikel Landa in the future. But for Remco, he doesn't have a rider on whom he can rely in order to answer any move from Sepp Kuss. He still has a big job on controlling both Roglic and Vingegaard. And then there is this third guy. And another piece of bad news is that Movistar doesn't have that guy either. And UAE, they might have. But I still wonder, how are they going to play their cards? Mark Soler, we have seen him right. Well,
Juan Ayuso this morning in the mix zone, he said that Mark Soler was their Sepp Kuss.
Was their Sepp Kuss?
Yeah.
Okay, and what's the role of Joao Almeida then? What will be Joao Almeida's role in the next 2 weeks?
Look stealthy and make everyone forget that he's riding the Vuelta a España, which he's doing very successfully so far.
Yeah, I mean, today, when I there was this moment on which there were three Jumbo and three UAE, and I was wondering who the third UAE was. You know, for a moment, I thought Finn Fisher-Black was having a day of his life, and then I realized that it was Joao Almeida. He's an excellent rider, don't get me wrong. I like him, and I like the way he races, because he's so counter-trend. You know, he's countercultural in this sport on which most of the big names are used to take the reins. You know, they are, so to speak, they are courageous. And Joao, on the other hand, it doesn't have anything to do with courage, but his way of racing, which is not that shiny, which is not that
funny. So you like him because he's boring, is what
yes,
you're saying.
I like him because he's boring.
He's defiantly boring.
Yeah, I did like Paco Mancebo. I did like Sergei yes. Gonchar back in the day. You know, I did like Cadel Evans.
There's an element of that with Roglic. One might say the typical sort of modus operandi of Roglic is quite boring, that the classic, the sort of quintessential Roglification, which you could say, if you take Chris out of the equation, you could say that's what today was. You know, never really put your nose in the wind and then win the sprint. But he's turned that into something that's so bad or so boring, it's exciting, perversely.
Yeah, exactly. It is the perfect villain or narrative on which Remco Evenepoel is the hero, you know. And about Sepp Kuss, there was a point that I forgot to make. The relevance or the importance of Sepp Kuss in the bigger picture is also to be strongly defined by how he performs on Tuesday's ITT. You know, if he does the best time trial of his life and he doesn't lose much time to Remco, we might find him in a position in which he can legitimately contend for victory.
Part of me, Fran, almost thinks that would be a shame if Sepp Kuss. I just don't want Sepp Kuss to waste 2 or 3 years of his career pursuing this. Sort of false dawn or this illusory goal of becoming a Grand Tour rider. We've seen it so many times in so many different ways. Some riders who have had to lose weight to do it, some riders who have had to, well, become better time trialists, maybe even put on weight to do it, and it's rarely worked. And there have been examples of riders completely changing in nature to win Grand Tours. Bradley Wiggins is a good example, but there have been other examples. But Sepp Kuss is so perfect in his current role that part of me hopes that he remains in that role and thinks he should remain in that role. And I think deep down he believes that he should remain in that role as well. Sort of pertinent to reflect on Sepp Kuss's journey as well today, him taking the first leader's jersey he's ever had in a major tour. And just to sort of, well, remember that he came from a minor, I think it's fair to say, American team. He had a history as a mountain biker, and then he had some good results in 2017, was picked up by Jumbo-Visma, and in the first sort of 6 months, as you would expect, Jumbo-Visma really struggled, and there was a nice symmetry to him taking the red jersey today, because his first race with Jumbo-Visma was the Volta a la Comunidad Valenciana. Is it called the Volta?
Yes.
Yeah. And he didn't finish that race. And that was in 2000 in the spring or early season 2018. That was the pattern for much of that season 2018, and then he had his sort of breakthrough at the Tour of Utah that year. And he's never really looked back. And he still has this sort of wide-eyed, naive quality to him. He sort of has the air of a kind of Huckleberry Finn type character, sort of setting off on an adventure with a haversack over his shoulder. And and that's also kind of why I kind of think Sepp Kuss. I would like him to remain as he is, because he fulfills that role in the broader sort of pantomime that is professional cycling.
And he fits in the role, you know. It is not a role that he has been assigned to by someone. He perfectly fits in the role. It's like we were saying about Joao Almeida, and as we were saying about Evenepoel and Roglic, in a sport that is basically fiction. Because it's basically fictional, because we barely see 10% of what a rider does in a day. We have to figure out what he has done most of the time, and we have to figure out the dynamics of a very large and very complex social group. It is so important to have a character to be identified and identifiable for not only for the media but also for the spectators at home, and even for the teams themselves, because even the teams themselves, sometimes they also don't know what the rider has been up to. So as long as he accomplishes the role that he has been assigned to, it is fine and it is all right. It is important to have a character to keep it. And Sepp Kuss is doing great at that.
He certainly is, Fran. He certainly is. Fran, one thing that struck me today, thinking back to other occasions when the peloton has come up to Jerez de Catia, and this was a climb, as soon as I saw it in the Vuelta back in 2000, I mentioned earlier that it had captured the imagination of the Spanish cycling watching public with those early visits, Chava Jimenez winning here, Eladio Jimenez. But one of the reasons why it did that was it was so extreme. And we had these, well, two in particular, In the first sort of decade of Jerez de Cati's history in the Vuelta a España. These extraordinary collapses. One you talked about the other day, Fabio Roscioli, the Italian rider who was in a break and, well, completely capsized, didn't he?
He lost 6 minutes in 3 kilometers.
He lost 6 minutes in 3 kilometers. And then there was another one in 2009. Ryan Taramine, the Estonian rider, was a very young professional at that point. He was riding for Cofidis. He was in the Estonian national champions jersey. And at one stage that day when the Vuelta visited in 2009, it looked very much as though he was going to take a breakthrough win. And an easy win at one point. He looked like by far the strongest rider in his breakaway group that day. However, it did not end well. We've spoken about this before on the podcast. I think the last time we came up here in 2017, we also spoke about it. But today, he was Ryan Taramine, who's riding the Vuelta, now 35 years old. He's very much in demand in the mix zone and very much enjoying, sort of perversely, reliving that, I suppose you could call it, fateful day in 2009. So Ryan Taramine is the subject of today's Encuentro del Día.
El encuentro del día, the meeting of the day.
Y ahí Taramae sufriendo probablemente como nunca en su vida, pero con ese aliciente, que es un triunfo de etapa en una vuelta grande. Ryan Taramae, cabeza de carrera.
How strange is it that everyone, well, remembers this one day, 14 years on? It wasn't the day when you won. Does it? What does it make you feel?
Yeah. For me personally, I still feel that same pain. I remember everything because it was really, really tough. It was very hot and really steep climb. And yeah, in those times you don't have enough gears. Now I have 34 in the back, 36 in the front. In the past I had 39, 23. So to get over of 23% slopes, or 3.5K, it's really almost impossible. And everybody remember it because everybody was sure that this guy is gonna win because I drop the others without coming out of my saddle, staying in my position just, and everybody dropped. But then, yeah, it's turned out catastrophe. And they speak it's one of the biggest crack of the latest year, so of course they remember.
Ryan, we don't see it on the television, but I saw a picture today that it looks as though you actually got off your bike. Is that right?
Yeah, I stopped alongside to the road for 10 minutes just to took a rest. And I remember one spectator came to me, put me water on my head, another put me apple in my mouth. I never had this kind of souvenirs, memories.
And when we watch it back, it just looks like so long ago. You know, the way that riders look on a bike looks totally different. What do you think when you look back at those images and think back to the start of your career?
Yeah, generally the level is just so high, much more higher, because everything is much more professional. And to be honest, I believe that that was the era between doping and between really professional training systems. So that was space that nobody really knew it, nothing. The youngsters was not so strong because we don't know it, how to train, how to prepare. But now, 15 years old, they train already like professionals, and when they get 20, they are Vuelta leader jersey like Martinez now. But that times was fun. To train was harder because you did a lot of mistakes. Sometimes you did 6 hours training and you eat only salad because you think that you need to be skinny. But now everything is changing. You know everything. If you trust your team, they tell you everything, how to become strong and how to maintain strong. It's actually much more easy now.
Do you wish you were starting your career now? Would that be a lot easier?
That's also hard because, there is much more talents now, and it's much more harder to make results. For example, before there was maybe friend of bus driver of team who this friend have son and he was good in cycling and they make him sign. But now they look the numbers. It's not this connection politic anymore. It's only about numbers. So they, if you have good numbers, they discover the good talents and they bring like that the guys on the cycling. It's not the word against word that I like this guy or like that guy, but now it's look numbers, this is the best, and now everybody look the riders like this, and then the average level is much more higher. So yeah, I think it's much more harder, and it was a little bit more easy before.
El ritmo de la vuelta. The rhythm of the vuelta.
This is El Ritmo de la Vuelta, in which we crank up the car stereo and terrorize the Spanish fauna with the schmaltzy ballads and clunking electro beats that have served as official anthems to the Vuelta a España down the ages. Today, Fran, the year is 1991. Were you born in 1991?
Yes, I was.
July 23rd. Was it the year of your birth?
Yes, July 23rd.
Tremendous. Today, the year is 1991, the year of Fran's birth. And once again, there seems to be some confusion, bizarrely, about what, in fact, was the official anthem of the Vuelta. Fran, do you know why whenever I look these up, there are always two different songs listed, depending on which source I consult?
There are years in which there were more than one song, and there was even a full Vuelta album soundtrack.
Ah, that would explain it. Anyway, you know the drill by now. Some sources, including Spanish national television's online archive, says one thing, other websites say another. I'm fairly confident, though, when I say that for the second time after their Masi Mas in 1989, Madrid New Wave Quartet La Unión did the honors with Dámelo Ya, or Just Give It To Me. Todo lo que tengas por un beso, dámelo todo amor, dámelo bien despacio, dámelo todo amor, dámelo bien despacio, los caprichos de tu cuerpo son. Well, started on April 29th, the same day that one of the deadliest cyclones ever recorded hit Bangladesh, eventually killing approximately 130,000 people. That day, Melchor.
Yes, he's Catalan.
That day, Melchor Mauri took the first Mayotte Amarillo after a team time trial in Mérida, won by Mauri's team. And the Catalan rider would retain the race leadership for all but three of the next 20 stages. His cause was no doubt helped by the cancellation of the Queen stage to Pla de Beret due to adverse weather. And since 1991, a legend has also flourished about a certain Canarian guy. Sorry, I'll do that again. And since 1991, a legend has also flourished about a certain Canarian gynecologist, Eufemiano Fuentes, and the contents of a package that he boasted about couriering to Mauri before the decisive time trial in Valladolid, 3 days from the end of the Vuelta. Mauri would finally win by just under 3 minutes from Miguel Indurain, and this was the closest Big Mig ever came to winning his home Grand Tour. Later that summer, he, of course, began his five-year reign at the Tour de France. Fran, you were born in 1991. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. What was the first Vuelta you watched?
I think my first Vuelta was probably 99. Well, 98. I remember already listening to the Spanish radio at night, because there was this moment in time on which the Vuelta, nearly 2 decades really, in which the Vuelta was more of a radio show than a TV show. Because there was this big radio host by the name of Jose Maria Garcia, who made a cause out of being the leading guy and about having a huge influence on every domain of Spanish society. And a show of his strength was projecting the Vuelta to become a very big sport event. So this alliance of sorts that he made with the organizers at the beginning of the 80s undertook him to be for 2 decades covering the race on a very intense manner that would be even unfathomable today. And I'm talking of a guy who had a live radio connection with the team cars of the Spanish teams, you know, and he would complain live in the radio to Javier Minguez or Eusebio Unzue whenever they were not doing what he thought they should do. you know, he would ask them to start pulling or to make a rider attack because the race was not being exciting at all. So his relationship with the Banesto team was marked by this moment at the end of the 80s, I think it was 87, on which they wanted Pedro Delgado to be a commentator during the Vuelta, even though he was still a professional rider. Delgado chose to go to with another station, another radio station, and that provoked the anger of Garcia, who for 2 years ignored the Reynolds team, going as far as to call them the team from Navarra and never citing their sponsor, because he even put under pressure Chavarri, and he put under pressure also the sponsor on itself, you know, because he wanted to have Delgado and he couldn't. And this was carried on until 98 Vuelta. In the 98 Vuelta, there was this duel between Chava Jimenez and Abraham Olano.
You're going to tell me this was the one where the Chava Jimenez... Abraham Olano's wife was... There was a live connection with her and this caused all sorts of problems between the two of them. Yeah.
Exactly. There was... Abraham Olano had the upper hand on the GC, but Chava Jimenez was a more enticing character. So Garcia supported Chava Jimenez and was certainly diminishing Olano as a rider. As you said, there was this crucial point, this low point, on which he made a live conversation between Echavarri himself and Carmele, who was Abraham's wife.
I think it was the stage to Lagunas de Nela.
I don't remember that detail really, but I remember hearing to that on the radio every night, because even my father and my uncle, who are not interested in cycling at all, were super invested on following this Vuelta because of the spat between Olano and Chava, and because of the spat that there was between José María García and his long-time lieutenant and now rival, José Ramón de la Morena. So whichever station you connected to, you would find two complete opposite versions of the race, and there were constant interpolations between them.
Fascinating. I wonder if we can arrange that, a live radio link up between the cycling podcast and one of the team cars. Which team would you pick? Whose team's tactics would you like to meddle with?
Movistar, definitely.
Movistar.
Yeah, but you know, in terms of getting something funny, I would definitely go with Jayco Alula, because I find that their DSs and their stuff are pretty cool. And in terms of getting interesting things, I would go with DSM, because I mean, the way that they have this seeming tension between the riders and the staff, you know, it would be so interesting to hear that, if that is expressed on the radio or it is only expressed whenever they want to adjust their saddle height.
Fran, very quickly, since you mentioned Movistar, what did you make of Movistar today and Enric Mas in particular?
Well, it was a fine stage for them, really. I mean, they managed to put two riders on the brake in order not to have to pull as they did the other day. And then afterwards, Enric was where he had to be. He didn't have the legs to power away from the favorites, yet he didn't lose time. I mean, he only lost 2 seconds. In my opinion, it is going better than expected to Movistar, considering that Enric has had a pretty short preparation for this Vuelta. And I am very curious to see how his performance evolves over the next 2 weeks. Today at the finish line, he seemed a bit angry or upset. I mean, probably I don't know if you noticed, but today he all struggled in the downhill section to the finish. He got gapped by 10 meters from the wheel of Vingegaard, I think it was, and he had to take a right turn very, very fast, you know, and he went a bit larger than he should have, and he risked a crash. I mean, he wasn't close to crash, but his trajectory, you know, his cornering was not as clean as the cornering of his rivals, and this probably creates a bit of stress in his mind, given his past struggles.
It was a very steep, it's a very steep swoop down to the finish here, isn't it? I actually felt sorry for the riders because I think all of them had their team vehicles on back on the other side of the climb. So they, once they'd come down that little descent, the steep descent to the finish, they then had to go back up over the summit of the Chaurette de Catie climb to get back to their team vehicles. But I know it could, in certain circumstances, be dangerous, particularly in wet weather. This would be a dangerous descent. But it does make for a spectacular finish. And this is one of those climbs that has a very sort of strong, well-defined visual identity. I think it's instantly recognizable if you turn on your TV and you have seen finishes here before. And yeah, it is a bit of a classic. I'm quite fond of it, I must say.
Yeah, and it also was set a trademark for the Vuelta because it is the original Murito. You know, the original wall, yeah. Of which is a style of sharp uphill finish, explosive, 1 to 3 kilometers long with double-digit gradients that has been used in the Vuelta time and again. It is no longer that present in this race, in this edition. I think
there were a couple of days in Asturias when we might. There are a couple of new ones.
Yeah, there is the stage in Cantabria to Bejes, which is a. It is a wall. Tomorrow we are having a sort of wall. Today was sort of a wall as well, but I don't think we have many more. Maybe Laguna Negra, we can consider that to be another wall finish. But for a few years, the Vuelta was the race of the walls. And luckily, the time has passed, and now it has a more balance. And I think a very good designed route over the past year.
Also, I would say, crucially, the 3 weeks are pretty well balanced. I said earlier that Mikel Landa had his hardest week, or the course was probably least suited for Mikel Landa this week. But actually, all 3 weeks are probably going to offer a similar amount of drama, suspense, entertainment. Fran, talking about what we've got ahead, let's look ahead, shall we, to tomorrow.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Well, Fran, yesterday's dinner, one question I've got for you. Coca pizza. Is that, are you familiar with that term?
Yeah, it's used here in Alicante, especially.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And what do you understand by that? Because that's what I had last night.
So it's a pizza, only that the base of this pizza is different. It has a bit more of a sugar taste, and it is a bit thicker.
It was very good. It was kind of similar to an Italian focaccia or a French, southern French fougasse. That's what I ate last night with aubergine on top, and it was quite delicious. A few other things as well, some vegetarian croquetas, some nice Monastere wine. And things are improving on a gastronomic front, Fran, as we maybe because we're edging down the country towards your neck of the woods, to your home region, although we're not going to make it into Andalusia, are we? We don't even touch Andalusia this year, do we?
Not this year. That means that next year we will have 10 stages in Andalusia.
I'll be there.
You know, Fran, what my dinner was yesterday, man?
Go on.
A banana and 2 Boldan beers.
Oh, Fran.
I mean, really, really. I mean, it was. I made it to the hotel at 11 p.m. and I was so tired that I thought I only wanted a beer. And then I thought a banana wouldn't kill me. And that was my dinner. It was not, I mean, no nutritionist. I mean, I didn't weigh the banana, by the way. Maybe that's the reason of my low performance today in the gym.
Fran, we were talking yesterday about Miguel Martinez, the father of Lenny Martinez. And how he lived for about 4 years on just carrot sticks from Lidl, 99 cents, because he couldn't afford anything else, so he said. Fran, what about tomorrow's stage? Please tell us what we have got in store.
Well, I'm afraid to say that tomorrow's stage in Murcia won't probably be a blockbuster, really. I don't think so, really. Well, stage 9, 184.5 kilometers between Cartagena and Caravaca de la Cruz, and an uphill finish. Between kilometer 48 and 60, we are climbing one of the sides of the renowned Alto de la Perdiz. This is Alejandro Valverde's favorite climb. It is also the key point of the Trofeo Guerrita, which is an under-23 race that Juan Pedro López won in an extraordinary fashion back in 2018 with a 70-kilometer breakaway on his own. But, you know, I have great memories of that day in Guerrita, but there is one memory that you and I share. that outclass is anything Juanpe might ever do, it was in the Verdict that our beloved colleague Richard Moore, you and I, recorded together a podcast some years ago on a tiny home on a day on which Rich was undergoing some heavy back pain and waiting for us, lying beside a pool. Do you remember that?
At the tomorrow's finish?
At the tomorrow's Alto de la Perdiz, which is midway to the stage.
I don't remember this.
Yeah, I remember it clearly, and it's a fond memory for me. And well, back to the stage on itself. Both the initial and the final sections are flat and straightforward, which probably won't help animating the race. We are going through Mula, which is the home of Luis León Sánchez and his brother Pedro León, a famous footballer. And we are going also through Calasparra, where they grow a rice that is deemed to be the best one in the world for paella because of its high absorbance rate. It's quite spherical. Anyway, it will all came down to the regular climb out of Caravaca de la Cruz to the Collado, the eponymous Collado. Ramps at steep at 20%, intertwined with downhill sections, will await the riders. And here comes my question for you, Daniel. Next year, Caravaca de la Cruz is having a year of jubilee, that is, jubilation. Will tomorrow's be the day of its roglification?
No, because I think tomorrow looks a bit more conducive for a breakaway.
I don't know. I mean, it is straightforward in the middle part, you know? If a peloton really commits to try and keep the gap down to a certain margin or even to narrow it, they have a perfect 40-kilometer section of flat ahead of the climb.
Who's going to pull hard, Fran, to keep that together tomorrow? Jumbo-Visma had a difficult day tomorrow. Today. I don't think there's too much for them to gain tomorrow. I think that they are probably looking ahead to the time trial at this point, the time trial that comes immediately after the rest day. There are a lot of riders a long, long way down on general classification now, the riders who lost another 5, 10, 20 minutes. So it shouldn't be too difficult for a break to go away with riders in it that pose no threat to Sepp Kuss's red jersey. So I don't know, maybe a straightforward breakaway tomorrow with Jumbo-Visma sort of taking the reins and really winding things up close to the bottom of the final climb. I'm not sure.
Well, you know, it's just a matter of you and I convincing one team each and acting as DS is tomorrow. Okay, I take Ineos. Okay.
I'll take Movistar.
Okay, Fran. Many of you know that Sudal Quickstep's James Knox is keeping an audio diary for the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España, and James sent in his latest entry just as we were about to hit the airwaves tonight.
Here we are, hotel again, stage 8. Big old day out, that. Proper day out, that. That was hard work. In a silly way, kind of more enjoyable than yesterday, to be honest, just blasting around. Ever a start of a race where nearly all the riders know the roads. It's that one amount of teams that are down in the Calpe area doing riding around Val d'Ebo and stuff. So yeah, straight out of Denia, 20k first climb, very hard. And then yeah, chilled for a little bit, and then unsurprisingly it was hard again. First FTJ started for a bit and then Jumbo came and joined them, and it was new last sort of 50k for me. Didn't know that they had not been that far over and I'd not done the last climb, which was hard. To be honest, I was feeling quite good. Sort of stayed up there with the boys all day. Was hoping I'd last further on the climb, but after about 500 metres of them, I would guess guys were doing burners. I was in the sort of back of the group with maybe just 25 guys left. Felt my legs going, realised wasn't going to be any of the help, so just at that moment sat up and went easy. Let a few stragglers come past me. Thomas was fighting valiantly after his get down, after his spill yesterday. Yeah, but Remco looked good. Kuss into red, which I am happy about, to be honest. I like Kuss. Very nice guy. Just maybe that's not the party line. I think we're deep into Alejandro country down here, down by Murcia tomorrow, I think. I've seen his Strava enough times, so I think we do a climb, one of the first climb tomorrow, which is prime valor climbing territory on his little Murcia training group. Been asked to elaborate on what Remco said into the camera yesterday. Just a bit of fun. He seems to enjoy mocking British accents or enjoys doing it himself. So, yeah. Alongside he's getting thrown around a lot. And for some reason, I think he just thought it was a good laugh to throw me under the bus live on TV. But anyway, we'll take that.
Okay, Fran, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you again. We will be having you again, I'm sure, in the coming days. I look forward to trying that rice tomorrow. And as I said, to things improving from a gastronomic point of view. We've seen a roglification at Choret de Cati. We've seen another fantastic stage to go with the others that have finished here over the years. Fran, have a great evening and make sure you get yourself a proper meal.
Hopefully, tonight. Hopefully.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.